Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcast. We're live from the deck on a beautiful late summer night. The humidity has finally escaped, and it's feeling more and more like state fair weather. It's drying out, and the sun is setting earlier, and I'm waiting for the leaves to start changing. I hate to say this, but it's coming, and it feels great after all the heat. But every year about this time, the heat kind of finally starts, it finally breaks, and I kind of feel that we're there. It probably will get hot again, but, and I love the heat, but this is fantastic. So, it's great to be out on the deck. I'm really kind of exhausted from all the travel that I've been doing in the last 6 weeks, and so tonight I just thought, I'm going to grab the portable recorder, and I'm just going to sit out here and do this podcast old school and kind of talk out some stuff. And we're going to do that. Some of my favorite stories from this week and this weekend, getting you set up for the next week in podcast 538, the Bob Davis Podcasts. Well, it is summer, and that means heat and humidity and these big storms, and there were some big ones this weekend. We're seeing all the stories on television about water damage and flooding down in Louisiana, and I was out in the western part of the state this week, and there is, you should see how high some of these creeks and rivers are right now with all this water, because there's so much rain coming out of these storms. So you can get hail damage. Obviously, tornadoes are always a concern, and especially water damage these days, and damage to the exterior of your home from these storms. And when you have the big storms, you got to ask yourself, who do I call for storm damage? Because it's always unexpected. You never think that you're going to have a problem. Well, you call a name that you know, and that would be Cairo Contracting. They've been in business for 15 years. Ed Cairo grew up in St. Paul and Bloomington. They are a Better Business Bureau accredited business. And because Ed Cairo is a local guy, he isn't going anywhere, obviously. They've been in business for a long time around town, residential and commercial roofing, siding, gutters, and window repair and installation. Here's the thing about Cairo. This is what they do. They do exterior damage repair, and they are storm damage specialists. So if you have a problem, whether it's hail damage, water damage, straight line wind damage to your house, call Cairo Contracting. For 15 years around here, here's the number, 612-702-2357, 612-702-2357. The banner at the top of the Bob Davis Podcast page also has the number in case you need it. You don't have to write it down. It's right there at the bobdavispodcast.com at the top of the page. Cairo Contracting, residential and business exterior remodeling experts and storm damage specialists. Remember, they are a Better Business Bureau accredited business, so you know you can trust them. The name you know when it comes to storm damage repair and exterior remodeling, residential and commercial, Cairo Contracting, 612-702-2357. That's 612-702-2357. Cairo Contracting. Yeah, I've been traveling, and I'm home pretty much now. I mean, I'm back pretty much. I came home from the air show, turned around and went out to Sturgis, came back, and then took another trip out to western Minnesota this weekend. And so I'm pretty, I put the truck back in its revetment. And I'm going to try to consolidate all the lessons from this travel in the next few weeks in some of the stuff that I talk about. And I'm going to try to start working on my next trip, which I'm not sure where I'm going to go. I know I have to go to Arizona in October. And so I'm thinking that I should go northwest, because I haven't taken Mobile Podcast Command northwest across to, I think it's to, through Montana, northern part of Montana and Oregon, you know, out, and then all the way down the Pacific Coast Highway to LA, and then back across the desert to Phoenix. And then I can come home, you know, through the Midwest, because I'm a little worried about getting too late and getting up in the mountains and getting into snow. And when you go through Denver, if you go that way, if you sort of go diagonally. So I'm starting to think about, where do I want to go, and trying to figure out the plan for the fall trip. And I haven't decided yet, but I'm working on that. And just, you know, you're going to hear me talking a lot about the places I went and the perceptions that came to me while I was traveling. And I didn't always put them in the podcast. And I've learned to do fewer podcasts and, you know, kind of put more content and quality into the podcast when I'm on the road rather than just spit them out willy-nilly while I'm driving. It's interesting how, and I'm just walking around and thinking and talking right now, but it's interesting how when it started, the travel podcast was in my Crown Vic, and I would go across the country in the Crown Vic. Then I got Mobile Podcast Command, and at first it was just grab the recorder and talk about where you are and your impressions as you drive through. Well, that's not working for me anymore. I have to go talk to people, and I have to get down in it and examine it and try to put more content into these travel podcasts. And I like it. I like what I'm doing. It's exhausting, though. I mean, the traveling is really getting exhausting. But it's, you know, the other thing is it's back and forth. So I went out, I came back, I went out, I came back, and when I come back, I do business, and I go to meetings and do other stuff and go back to yoga, and it's just funny how it's just, I just want to work. I want to get up. I want to work. I want to eat breakfast. I want to drink my coffee. I want to work. I want to go to yoga. I want to come home. I want to watch Game of Thrones, and I want to go to sleep. That's kind of, because there's a bunch of shows that I never got a chance to watch. Didn't get a chance to watch Game of Thrones, so I'm doing that now. You know, so it's just kind of funny how you go back and forth. But I am planning a fall trip, and I'm going to have to go up. You know, the reason that I'm thinking about this is because you can't, I'm afraid to take, there's no way that I'm coming back over those mountains, you know, in November, because, you know, after Election Day, it's just going to be too dangerous with the snow, because I'm sure up in the upper reaches. And so I have to actually research whether I can actually even go across those big mountains in Oregon and Montana and stuff in October, because I'm thinking it'll be okay. Like the first snows, it'll have snowed, I'm sure, by then, but in the big, you know, tall mountains. But hopefully it won't be, you know, 16 feet of snow where they're telling you got to put chains on, because I don't want to get stuck in the passes, you know, outside of Denver, 10,000 feet. Plus, I'm a little daunted by these high, you know, I don't know if you've ever driven through Denver, driven through Colorado on your way south. I don't even remember the name of that interstate. But coming down those hills, you're coming down hills, you know, it's 10,500 feet. You're coming down from 10,000 feet in some of those places outside of Denver. And I was worried about the brakes on the Crown Vic burning up. I'm afraid that the ambulance brakes might just literally burn up on the way down that hill. So I'm a little concerned about that. So lots of things to think about. And what I wanted to do in this podcast is just kind of do some of my favorite stories. But I will be sharing, you know, some of the observations I've had from those trips. So I came back from Sturgis and then went out to Western Minnesota again for a couple of reasons. First of all, and I'd forgotten that Brad, my friend in Deadwood, we sat up when I went to Deadwood for Sturgis. So first I went to Deadwood, then I went over to Sturgis, then I went to Mount Rushmore and Keystone and all those places. And if you listen to the podcast, you know that. Fantastic trip. It's beautiful out there this time of the year. I love Sturgis. I don't ride, you know, I don't have a motorcycle. I never have. The only time I ever rode a motorcycle was I worked with this guy at a radio station in Baltimore, and he was a motocross rider. And at that time, I mean, this is a long time ago, so we're not talking about the bikes they have now. And he invited me to come out and ride his bike, and I rode it and stripped the gears. He was not too happy about that. So that was the last time I rode a motorcycle, I think. So I'm not particularly interested in riding. I think it's super cool. I think the people that ride their bikes from like Maine out there in North Carolina to Sturgis, that would be a really fun thing to do. I think riding a motorcycle that far would be a trip, and it's fun to see them because they're all just weather beaten and burnt, and you know, you can just tell the people who have been riding all the way across the country to get to Sturgis because they look like they've been out in the sun for, you know, they look like they got big farmer's tans and their faces are all windburned, and I love that. It's got to feel great. So yeah, I really have a good time out there, and I love those people, and it's one of the great things in America every year, Sturgis. But I went to Deadwood because I love Deadwood, and I visited my friends Brad and Lori. And Brad will go on all night long. Like, he'll talk all night long. It's one of the few people I've ever met who talks more than I do and knows, like, way more than I do about everything. And we were talking about the Indian Wars, and we were talking about Custer, and we were talking about, because that's huge out there. That's part of the history of that region. And Brad was saying, you know, one of the bloodiest battles in the Indian Wars took place in Minnesota. And I was like, what? Because I always thought of the Indian Wars as happening way out west, like, you know, Utah and Arizona and places like that, because that's what the movies always showed us. But he was saying, yeah, I think he said New Ulm, Minnesota was a place where one of the bloodiest Indian Wars in history took place between the Dakota and the residents of New Ulm. So I thought, well, I'm going to New Ulm. Or I had a reason to go to New Ulm, and I'd forgotten that this went on. And I went out to New Ulm, and they got plaques all over there. And if you're from New Ulm, Minnesota, you know what I'm talking about. A mostly German town. I don't know how many of the residents at the time, because I didn't really read up on it, so forgive me. But I think most of them spoke German. I don't even know that they spoke English. And they ended up having to barricade the town and defend the town. And they've got these plaques all over the place that show where that took place. And Brad was saying that there were some atrocities committed, and then the townspeople wanted to hang these Indians, and they petitioned the government. And everyone thinks of Honest Abe Lincoln as this really nice old man, right? And Lincoln told them to hang all of them, and they didn't hang all of them. But this is a source of a lot of discord in the state of Minnesota, because the Dakota, you know, we're not thrilled, obviously, about this, and they're not thrilled about one-sided history. So I'm going to have to leave that and go back to that later at some point. But here's the point, is not to argue which side was right or wrong in the Dakota Wars. But what's interesting is that we don't realize that that took place right in Minnesota. That took place, you know, not far from South Dakota border, but it took place right here. I mean, that's a huge piece of Western history that took place here. So I went there. And then we ended up going down to the, what was her name? Laura Ingalls Wilder, whatever her name was, Little House on the Prairie Museum down in Walnut Grove, Minnesota. And that's interesting, too, not because it's a good museum, because it's, I hate to say this, and it's kind of mean, and I'm sorry. It's not really a very good museum, and it's not because there's not a lot of stuff in there. It's getting better. It's okay. But it needs some curation, because there's all this stuff from, you know, it's this polyglot. There's all this stuff from the prairie. There's all this stuff from, you know, the family and all that. And then you walk into a room and it's all this World War II stuff. And it's like, what's this? This doesn't make any sense. So there's a lot of that. But anyway, so the coolest thing in there, and I talked in the radio show this weekend about the risk that the people who came out here, you know, first in the regions west of the Mississippi and then into the full Louisiana Purchase, you know, in the 1860s and 70s and 80s and 50s and 40s, right? Those people who came here just encountered some really difficult times. So they do, one of the cool things they have there is they have a sod hut and then they have a settler's house or cabin, basically. And then they also have the wagons that they rode in going out to the far reaches of Minnesota. Anybody raised in Minnesota has seen this stuff or they've heard about it, right? So this is nothing new. But I think it's really cool to see it. You really see how they rode out there in the Conestogas, you know, and then they had to live in those things for a year, and then they got into a, you know, they got into a sod hut, which was like heaven, you know, and then they got into a cabin of some kind, right? So that was life. Well, the coolest thing about the whole thing, and I'm going to say this very quickly because this is what I really wanted to say, you know, so they've got this exhibit in there that's all this stuff that she wrote about, and they've got a model, and I assume it's real. So I always thought of locusts as cicadas, basically little bugs that's what I thought locusts were. And I'm always reminded, I was reminded again, that the locusts were in fact these giant grasshoppers, okay? So I didn't realize how big they were. There is a model in there, and it's confirmed by the pictures they have, too. These frickin' things were literally bigger than your hand. So if you're a man, hold your hand out, you know, or a woman. But I mean, if you're a typical man, hold your hand out and spread your fingers out, you know, in front of you, right or left. And this thing would, the back legs would be on your front two fingers, your index, your the middle finger and the you know, the index finger or whatever. And the front feet would be on the far palm, like the beginning of your wrist. That's how big they were. I mean, wow. I was like, and you know, they talk about those things coming in and eating the crops, and they tried all kinds of stuff to get rid of them. And it was pretty amazing. And that's just one of the things that those people had to endure, whether it was that or the new people in New Ulm dealing with Indians. And, you know, I was never a big fan of Little House on the Prairie. I was much more of a Star Trek kind of guy and a Battlestar Galactica kind of guy. But I'm kind of on this trip right now about Western history because the deprivations of these people were far worse than anything you could come up with in Star Trek or, you know, something like that. Even though the TV shows are whitewashed, but when you actually look into the history, so, you know, this is going to be something I'm going to be talking more and more about, and especially when I go northwest, because I'm fascinated with all that, right? Well, with the return from the outer reaches of the frontier, I can go back to my yoga classes, and it was great to get back to yoga this week. I don't know what you do for exercise, whether it's SoulCycle, CrossFit, lifting, competitive sports, whatever. I practice yoga, and I do it in crowded rooms of over 100 degrees with high humidity where you sweat a lot and you can get dehydrated. And I see people all the time end up sitting on their mats because they get dehydrated. And they think if they drink a bunch of water before a class that that's going to hydrate them, except tests have shown that what happens with people is if you drink a half quart of water or whatever, 16 ounces of water before a class, it can take up to 45 minutes for your muscles to get hydrated. And this is why we use Hydrus, because Hydrus gets hydration. It gets, you know, key electrolytes to your muscles very, very quickly using exclusive nanosome technology. And they do it without sugar. So they can get electrolytes into your muscles with unrivaled speed and effectiveness with no sugar that you have in these traditional sports drinks, which is why Hydrus is being used by wrestlers for weight cuts. It's being used by tennis players. It's being used by key athletes all over the place because it's amazing. I thought that soreness went with the territory with yoga and that being exhausted after yoga class was part of the territory, but I realize now that I was dehydrated, and when I found Hydrus, it transformed my yoga practice because now I can go to the edge, and now actually I feel that I'm actually practicing yoga. For more information, go to hydrusperformance.com. That is HYDRUS, HydrusPerformance.com. You can click on the ad at the top of the Bob Davis podcast page. There's all kinds of information on the Hydrus site about what it does, how to get it, and every time people get a sample of this stuff, so if you get to see me someplace, I usually have it with me, I can give you a sample. People who sample it, they try it for almost anything, you know, talking a lot or walking or running or hunting even, you know, and then they want to get more because it's an amazing product. HydrusPerformance.com, HYDRUS, Hydrus Performance. So when I do these kind of walk and talk podcasts, it's really hard for me because usually I have an outline to work from, and I don't do that, and so I'm playing without a net, and I hate to ramble on and on about stuff, because I feel like I never get to the point, and that drives me nuts, so I'm sorry if that has happened. But the thing about the history, and planning the trip out west, going across the northern route all the way out through Montana into Oregon, and then down the Pacific Coast Highway, the Great Northwest, so to speak, so you'd be following the Burlington Northern Route, basically to Seattle. The thing that's fascinating to me about history, and this has always been what's fascinating to me, and the more I study, the more it's fascinating, is if you look at it from the point of view of the people who lived during the period you're looking at, whether it's the museum about airplanes at the EAA or the Laura you know, Ingalls Wilder, whatever museum, Little House on the Prairie thing out in Walnut Grove, or, you know, the Civil War or anything else, is understanding what that their perspective was. This was the latest stuff. This was their world. This, they didn't, they would have thought the world that we live in would be fantastic. You know, the idea that a repeating rifle was new technology, the idea that the railroad was really something, you know, that was like, you know, the internet today. That was a huge thing. Working for the railroad would be working like working for Google. And we think of people, oh, what's a conductor? What's a train conductor or a train engineer or a fireman or something on the train? Well, that was a big high-tech job in those days. Or, you know, I don't know, the telegraph operator who had to have a specific skill, or somebody that had to run the local stations or handle, you know, any of that stuff. And I'm not going to go on and on, but their world. So they came to the far reaches of the frontier on a wagon. And when you see the wagons, you're like, oh my God, that's horrible, you know. But that was new technology for them. That was like, this is how we're going to get to wherever we're going, and we get to take our stuff with us, and we don't have to, we can ride. The women can ride, or the children can ride, or whatever. That was a big deal. You know, a wagon train, the wagon wheel with the metal band around it was a big deal. It could be pulled by horses and so on. And I just think about that, and I think about our world. What is our world's frontier? And so I'm really on this theme of those people and what they did, and how our ancestors are going to look upon us, you know, just 100 years from now. Keep in mind, you know, this whole thing in the West really was just a little bit more than 100 years ago. So think of the 1980s and the 1990s. And in the 1880s and 1890s, that was the time of Tombstone and Deadwood and the late 1860s or early 1870s. Really, in our time, not that long ago, 30 or 40 years ago, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, that was Western history, you know, 100 years ago. So 100 years from now, how are people going to view us? I find that interesting. And then I look, after that, I look at my daily stories, and I look and I see things, and what floats to the surface for me isn't the economic stuff that confirms a lot of what I said in the radio show this weekend about this election, and I'm not going to get back into that because it's low energy, but it is the brave new world that we are heading into with the new crust of technology that is being created and how it is affecting how people think and what is going to happen in the next 20 to 50 years in this country, that people who are alive in their, you know, 20s or 30s studying history in 2052 will look back to 1952 as ancient history, and they'll go to the museums and they'll see, you know, the 1969 Dodge Charger or something, and they'll go, look at how primitive it was, and, you know, or they'll see things that, like, for instance, when I went to the museum, the EAA museum, there's a bunch of old planes in there, old mail planes and stuff like that, and, you know, these planes flew at about 9,000 feet, maybe 10,000 feet. They had to get up over the top of some mountains. They were, you know, these guys were sitting outside in these mail planes, most of them. They weren't covered. They didn't have heat, you know, and it's pretty primitive. But it was pretty new technology because they could fly the mail and they could get the mail to a place overnight. That's a big deal, being able to communicate with New York, you know, in a couple of days versus a week, you know, and being able to get a letter from your aunt, you know, or get a check from somebody in a day was a big deal. That was new technology. And we think we are living in the future because we have computers and we have iPhones. Someday an iPhone is going to be in a museum, and people are going to look at it the way they look at an Apple IIG that's in a museum and go, look at that thing, you know, look at that giant boxy thing. That was the first Apple computer. And now we have these iPhones, and we think we're living in this high technology future, but we're building the crust of a new age that is coming. And this is what I want people to think about, because it's this shifting back and forth between looking at people who were pioneers in the 1860s and 70s and 80s and 90s in the far reaches of the western part of this country, which had been unsettled and there were all kinds of deprivations and problems, and they went ahead and they took the risk. risks. We're living in this world where we're constantly being beaten down and told that there's no hope and that terrible things are going to happen. And great things are just outside of our reach if we can just reach out and embrace them and realize that they don't mean what they say that they mean. Here's another story I found this week, which is entitled The Brave New World of Robots and Lost Jobs, and it's all about how robotics and autonomous machines and everything else are going to create such a high loss of jobs that we are going to have to figure out how to give people a universal basic income. And people will always say, you know, this technology thing, what's going to happen someday when these new autonomous machines and driverless cars and nobody has a job, what are people going to do? And so you're already having these politicians starting to say, well, we're going to have to give people a guaranteed basic income because they're not going to have a job. And I'll just read you some statistics so that there's some content in this podcast, and that's just me popping off. They're talking about this thing called the automation bomb, which is supposed to make you scared of automation. But automation has been a part of our structure of life, and as you'll see in a second with another story, in this country for, you know, since machines were developed. And really all they did was they coupled the computer with machinery to create autonomous things, whether they are robots or whether they are autonomous software or whatever, that operate machines that human beings don't have to. And as the software gets better and better and better and quote-unquote smarter and smarter and smarter, it's able to do things that human beings can't do as well as machines do them. I see them as tools. I don't see them as threats. I see them as just better tools. Think of how somebody may have seen the factory in 1840 or 1850 or 1860 versus somebody who grew up on a farm and or saw how they might have seen some kinds of farm automation at the time. And you understand a little bit about what I'm talking about. I'm going to get to the farming thing in a minute. But it talks about this automation bomb having the potential to destroy, and that's the term that they use, 45% of the work activities currently performed in the United States and how much money it represents in wages. And we're supposed to worry about this. This is this potential, you know, horrible thing that what we've got to do is we have to guarantee people a basic income to prevent this from happening. But the gist of this is we've only seen the beginning of change. Right now, only 5% of occupations can be entirely automated, but 60% of occupations could soon see machines doing 30% or more of the work. And then later on, they talk about this McKinsey study, and they talk about 90% of what welders, cutters, and solderers and brazers do now could be replaced by machines. In food service and accommodation, 73% of the work could be performed by machines. In retailing, 53% of the work could be lost. White-collar workers may imagine that they're safe, but that's wishful thinking. In fact, white-collar workers, where autonomous software is really having a huge impact now, whether it's in communications, insurance work, offices don't need the space that they used to have because robots are actually replacing workers around the world. Now, I don't want to read the whole article, but I will tell you I saw an article this weekend about Elon Musk's big new factory out in the deserts in California, and everyone's talking about how he's building this mega factory to build batteries. And the implication is that Elon Musk is going to create all these jobs for all these people that are going to be working in this factory. And now you're starting to see reporting come out that, in fact, a lot of this factory is going to be automated. It's going to be robotics. So it won't create the jobs that they're talking about. I mention it because it's a common thread of political thought right now that our jobs were boxed up and sent over to China. But in fact, most of the jobs lost in the last 45 years in this country are due to IT and due to low-cost labor comparative advantage, and not just in foreign countries, but in states of the United States. For example, I read recently that for almost every automobile plant closed in the upper tier in the United States in the Great Lakes region, in the last 25 or so years, they've opened one in the southern tier, right-to-work state region, because it's substantially less expensive to produce cars down in Tennessee and in Kentucky and places like that in Texas than it is to produce cars in Detroit because of the differences in cost. And before you jump off and start, I don't want to get too political, but The thing about cars is it's better to produce close to the market, which is why BMW and Volkswagen and, you know, all the foreign companies also have plants in the United States, because rather it's, you know, why have the cost of shipping cars all the way over the sea when you can, and the potential loss of inventory, you know, if something happens, when you can produce those cars right in the United States. So it's the same thing. They're not, BMW's not building plants in Detroit. They're building them in Tennessee and places like that. Why? People don't think about that. And a lot of those plants, and this is true, definitely true in the steel industry as well, a lot of those plants are automated. I want people to think about what we're going to do when, and it's going to happen quickly, when machines do a lot of the work that we used to get to do, or we used to have to do, depending on how you look at it. I want people to think about what your kids and what your grandchildren are going to do, because new jobs are going to be invented. You know, I am worried that we have, you know, people that are saying we've got to give people a guaranteed income so that they just sit around and do nothing, because somehow these machines are going to idle all these people and there'll be nothing for them to do. Well, I think people will come up with things to do. There will be new things invented that will require people. And people will say, well, what's going to be invented? Well, I don't know. We don't know because we haven't invented it yet. So this fear of machines taking over people's jobs and having huge numbers of the population idled, I don't know if that's a reliable fear. And I think it's a negative concern. So let's talk about farming very quickly. Farming has used to employ a very large proportion of the workforce, especially in the Midwest in this country. But over the decades, because of technology and modernization, employment has fallen persistently in good years and bad through war and peace, expansion and recession, and they have slashed millions of jobs. Now, if you asked about any industry that did that, you would think, oh, well, what industry would it be? This was farm. It used to employ something like 60% of the workforce. Over 50% of the workforce labored on the farm in the 19th century. Now it's probably less than 2% toiling on farms. And you think, oh, that's just a terrible thing. I used to have people call me on the at the talk station and say, this is terrible what's happened. And yet, America, farming is one of the leading export sectors in the world, and certainly it's one of the leading export centers of our economy. $100 billion a year exports in agriculture. What's producing all that agriculture? What's producing all that output? Well, you know, machinery, so that farmers can produce more and more and more with less and less than less, and it's going to continue to grow. One of the great markets for robotics and IT is, in fact, farming. New machines can do things that people used to have to do in agritech, all kinds of things that do things like, for example, harvest and spray for the farmers are now being developed. There's also one that collects data. You know, you just throw it in the field and it rolls around and collects data on soil and water composition in the soil. There's another one that waters crops and decides how much to put in there. There's a new autonomous farm opening in Japan that will produce lettuce, and the humans will still plant the seeds, but every other step from the transplanting of younger seedlings to larger spaces on this lettuce farm to harvesting will be done automatically, and they expect that the output will go from 21,000 to 50,000 heads a day. So you're seeing more and more automation in agriculture as well. So the whole point of this is not to just brag about all these great, new, wonderful things. It's we cannot see the world that will come. Our ancestors that pioneered farming in the Midwest in the early 1900s all the way back to the 1860s could not possibly have foreseen the combines on fields today. They could not possibly have foreseen that a whole family of 10 kids wouldn't be required to work a small plot of a family farm. Today, it's 2% or less of the general population producing way more output than those people ever produced. They could not see the world where people are employed writing newspapers or doing podcasts or, any number of other things, working at Google and places like that. So we can't see what the future will hold in terms of employment. And all I hear when I pick up the newspaper or watch television or whatever are these politicians decrying this stuff and talking about how we've got to figure out how to pay people minimum wages and how we've got to create guaranteed incomes and we've got to take care of people without thinking about where we're going. And I just want to leave you with that thought. We've got to start thinking about where we're going to go and what we're going to do with these new technologies, because they're coming. And I think about those people were super excited about new technologies. You know, when the telegraph came in, they didn't go, well, that's going to put people out of work. They were like, the telegraph, wow, I can get a message to Chicago and order my crops by telegraph. So just use the example of farming. In 1900, the farmers couldn't possibly have imagined what their children and their grandchildren would do. And just as in 1950, the people couldn't possibly have imagined the jobs that have been created by new technologies since then. And if you just, this is the cool thing about history, is if you look at it from both ways. So you think and you go through a museum and you look at stuff from 100 years ago. But then if you flip it and you think about, gee, wonder what people will be looking at in museums 100 years from now. What about our life will happen that we couldn't possibly predict? And I think when we think about pessimism, we think so often in pessimistic and negative ways. We are taught to think about only the problems that artificial intelligence would create, or only the problems that autonomous machines and autonomous software and automation would create. But what these things do is continually free human beings to invent and create new things and move the world forward. Our biggest problem in this time is we think so negatively about things that really are amazing, that we should be happy about, that we should be thrilled about. We only think negatively about it. You know, I'm sure if you said to somebody in a Conestoga wagon, would you like to fly to Minnesota instead of riding in this wagon for 6 months? They would have said, let's go. Flying? Are you crazy? Yeah, I got a plane over here. I'll take you. You know, they would have been amazed at the opportunity to be able to fly to Minnesota to start their farm, or be able to have their farm arrive on a truck or a dirigible or something that they could build their little house without having to live in a mud hut for 6 months to a year, or to weather a winter with not very much to keep them warm. So we just think so negatively, and we're being taught to think so negatively. And people wonder, why are people so upset, and why are all these terrible things happening, and why are people acting so weird, and social media this, and you know, television that, and these politicians and everything else? Because we're not thinking about the possibilities anymore. We're not thinking positively. We're not thinking and having faith in our own creativity. Let people, you know, figure this stuff out on their own, and they will. They didn't have jobs banks in 1863. Those people, you know, got in their wagons and came out here on faith. They came out here on faith, and they didn't know that they were going to encounter grasshoppers either. You know, they encountered the grasshoppers later, and I'm sure they were horrified. And again, as I said in the radio show, a lot of those people didn't make it, but you know what? It was a hell of an adventure. All right, so let's try to think positive, shall we, as we head into the week with all this crazy negative stuff. Thanks once again to Hydrus Performance for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcast all these months. Whether you do cycle, CrossFit, lift, competitive sports, Hydrus makes a huge difference. It's the new high-performance beverage that uses exclusive nanosome technology to get critical electrolytes into your muscles with unrivaled speed and effectiveness. No sugar, no sugar, no sugar, no sugar. Click on the banner at the top of the Bob Davis Podcast page. Takes you to hydrusperformance.com. You can read more about it. Get some and enjoy. And with summer, and even late summer, comes these big, big storms. We had a lot of storms just this last weekend. A lot of water damage. If you have water damage, if you have hail damage, if you have wind damage to the exterior of your home, let me give you a name that you can call, that you can trust to take care of that problem. Cairo Contracting. They are a contracting firm that only does residential and commercial roofing, siding, gutters, and window repair and installation. Basically, only exterior work. Cairo Contracting is a Better Business Bureau accredited business. Ed is a local guy. Here's the number, 612-702-2357. That's 612-702-2357, Cairo Contracting. Well, of course, it was Alpha Systems that introduced me to EAA and that museum out there, and that was just a fantastic experience, and I learned a lot. And if you're a pilot and you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings, here's something for you to learn. Alpha Systems makes the revolutionary angle of attack indicator. Bottom line, it's a visual indicator of your lift as you turn on final approach to land. This is the biggest problem in general aviation. People literally are killed because they don't realize that they can lose lift on that final turn. Their visual display is the best in the business. It lets you know how much lift you have so that you can be safe. And pilots want to get there, but they want to be safe. If you want more information, click on the Alpha Systems banners for more info about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator at thebobdavispodcast.com. All right, I'm going to make this short. Thank you guys for listening on Stitcher.com, iTunes, TuneIn, blogtalkradio.com. Thanks for signing up for the Bob Davis Podcast newsletter at thebobdavispodcast.com. And for your donations at thebobdavispodcast.com for Mobile Podcast Command. And of course, I appreciate the likes and the shares and the favorites and the following on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And thanks for listening to Podcast 538, The Bob Davis Podcasts. Back to the tiki torches.